My guest this evening on the Kevin Smith Show is someone who is well known to the Kevin Smith Show audience, and we're delighted to have him back with us this evening, having just returned from recently returned from his latest expedition to the Amazon, the jungle, and historical ancient places in South America. He is the associate host of the Kevin Smith Show, and he is the executive producer for Expeditions TV, Jerry Wills. Jerry, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin, and hello, everyone. It's good to be back.
Jerry, you got back about Christmas time, didn't you?
Yeah, we got back on Christmas Eve, actually. It was late afternoon.
All right, now, you tell us a little bit about this was a little different kind of a trip that you took. It's not your normal expedition that you usually do. So tell us a little bit about this trip, what it was for, and where you went.
Well, originally the trip was set up to be just a journey into the Amazon. We were going there for 12 days with an entourage of folks who wanted to meet with the shaman that we are friends with there in the jungle, and they also were interested in doing the sacred ceremonies of the shaman using ayahuasca. And that was about all we were planning on doing. This time of year in Peru is typically very rainy, and going into the highlands looking for lost cities and such, it's raining too much, it's very cold, snow, ice. You know, it's just not the time of year to do that sort of thing. But then things changed, and about a month before we were to leave, a friend of mine, who also runs a tour company, he and I started talking again. I hadn't spoken to him in about a year or so, and he informed me that he had colorectal cancer. It had moved into his genitals and up into his abdomen, and that he was in very, very bad condition. And the kicker was that he had a trip with people who had signed up to go, and he was not going to be able to go there. And, of course, his wife needed to stay there with him to help him because he's bedridden. So he said he didn't know what he was going to do, and of course, I had a clear idea, and I suggested that Kathy and I take the trip for him and meet with these folks and take them on their journey, which was another 12-day journey. So everything worked out, and we were doing it simply to help him, you know, no money involved. And so then I had a new event on our plate, so to speak. So that was the second half of our amazing journey into Peru. It basically was, the second half was more of a tourist exercise than it was doing anything. But, you know, these folks had never been there, and we know places, and it was going to be an exciting time for them.
So you made your way down the Amazon. And I understand you had some challenges along the way. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, we went to the lodge, and we found out once we arrived that there's we were going because of the rain. And let me first explain that this time of year in the Amazon, there are terrific thunderstorms. It rains buckets. And it's a very interesting time to be in that part of the world. Well, we found out when we arrived that had we come just 10 days earlier, the river that leads to the lodge, it had been completely dried up. The Amazon is experiencing its worst drought in recorded history. So, fortunately, it had rained some, and we could get up the river. The challenge is basically that were probably the funniest. I took everyone to a neighboring tribe called the Bora, and these folks They were imported basically from northern Peru. They had been headhunters 100 years ago, and now they live in the area just outside of Iquitos in the jungle. I've known the Bora tribe for 20 years. They've been, you know, like an extended family for Kathy and I. When we took our entourage with us, the people, companions on this trip, they said, would you like to come to our village? Would you like to come see our village? And that's quite an honor to be asked to their village, because all you really ever see is this very large place, a clearing in the jungle, where they do their dances and do their quote-unquote tourist thing. So we were invited to their village. So when we left there, we got back on the boat, went upriver a ways, and parked, and we had to go, I thought, through another part of their tourist extravaganza. But instead, it was the Hebrew tribe had located their village right there on the river, and in order to get to the village of the Bora, you had to walk through the Hebrew.
How are you spelling that? You said Ibiru?
It's like gibbero. It's J-I-B-E-R-U, not an O.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure that I'm sure someone's got a spelling for their tribe, but these guys were pretty fierce. They were fierce headhunters who actually lived in this region for recorded history. Well, here are 15 white people, tall white people, marching up this hill, walking up this hill into their village, and there to meet us at the top of this hill is this little short guy about waist high to me, and he's wearing all this grass from neck to feet.
Grass.
He's wearing, yeah, like streamers of grass. I don't know what it was. But I thought it was pretty far out. I had never seen anybody dressed like that, considering how hot it was. It was about 95 degrees and 100% humidity. And he's stomping his feet and yelling at me and shaking his hands, and I don't know what he's saying. And fortunately, our guide spoke the language, and his name was Wilson. You know, like on that Tom Hanks movie, the ball?
With
hair, you know, grass sticking out of the top. Well, his name was Wilson, and Wilson proceeds to tell me that we are not welcome to walk through their village to get to the Bora village. So I said, why not? I mean, they've got all kinds of little beads and baubles hung up for tourists to take a look at and buy. And there he is, right there. And so this guy is taking his right hand, throwing it over to his left shoulder, and he's going, get out of here. And I said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going where I'm going. And so a little bit of an argument ensued. So I basically told him that I was one of the gods, and that I had a right to walk through this village, because after all, being one of the gods, this was my jungle. You know,
and what was his response to being confronted by one of the gods?
He said, I really don't give a dang. I won't use the term he used, but he says, I really won't give a dang. I really don't give a darn who you are. You're not walking through my village. And he stomped his foot and just looked at me and gritted his teeth at me. It was funny as hell. I'd like to have gotten a picture of that.
Well, you did get a picture of him pointing over his shoulder there.
Yeah, he's telling me to go away.
Uh-huh.
And I just pulled it. He didn't want his picture taken, so I made sure I took it.
See, of all of the natives that you could have run into and played that I'm a God card, You had to run into an atheist.
I know. Can you imagine? I did tell him that I was co-host for the Kevin Smith Show.
Oh, that would have done it.
Well, I did, and he said, well, then give me $20.
Oh, well, okay. Well, there you go, see?
So I did, and he let us pass. You know, when we heard the name Kevin Smith, he got quiet for a very long time.
Well, it strikes fear in the hearts, yes, it does. So this guy doesn't care. I mean, there you're standing nearly 7 feet tall. And, yeah. You know, I had to sort of, to myself, I had one of those little private mental chuckles a moment ago when you said this, it was a little bitty guy about waist high. That's about where I am with you.
Yeah, well, you're a little taller than that. You come up to my elbow.
So there you're standing, almost 7 feet tall. And how's your hair now? You have long hair, or have you got it cut?
Oh, well, here's the story. You see, I was letting it grow long. It was down around my shoulders. And it was, like I said, 95 degrees and no rain. And really, not much in the way of a breeze. So it was like wearing a fur hat.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was smothering. You know, the way it is there at night, I mean, it's this temperature at night as well, which is unusual for this time of year, but it's a drought. But you're laying there in bed. These are not fitted sheets. They're just a sheet thrown over a mattress. And the mattress is foam rubber, so it just basically makes you even hotter.
Mm-hmm.
So you're laying there, trying not to move, praying for a small breeze, and then you turn off to your left or to your right, and the next thing you know, it's like you're wrapped up like a salami. The sheets are just like having a big piece of cellophane that just wraps around you like saran wrap. Well, I got just really tired of this big fur hat that I had going with the hair. And I told Kathy it was making me crazy. She says, well, tie it back. I said, well, it's not long enough to tie back yet. So just cut the stuff off. Just, you know, here's a knife. Cut it off.
Uh-huh.
Well, she used to be a beautician, so she carries her things with her all the time. Mm-hmm. And she just pulled out her scissors and said, sit down and shut up and don't complain about this. And the next thing you know, I have a haircut like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's astonishing. I actually look quite good now that I look more like you.
Well, if you'd get a little bit, you get her to kind of shave the top of your head so it'll be bald like me, you'll be in high style then.
Well, I was going to get a hat like the one you're wearing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't exactly fit the adventure motif that I'm trying for.
Yeah, it really doesn't fit the style you need there. So you're standing in front of this guy. You're out in the jungle. You're almost 7 feet tall. You could step on this guy and just make him disappear almost. And you pull the God card, and he says, I don't care who the heck you are. You're not going through here. And then after you paid him some money, he said, okay, you can go through here. Capitalism has made it to the jungle.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I had some pretty interesting moments to shoot some pictures of walking through their village. It was just sticks, you know, just very crude huts. We walked back through the jungle for about an hour before we got to the Bora tribe, and it was quite a wonderful walk. The funniest thing about all this, aside from the fact this guy was like, I don't care who you are, the people that were with us, because they didn't know what to experience. There are guys standing around with spears, with sticks, and they basically have no clothes on. And the women, the same way. They basically are standing around naked as well. And this fellow is stomping his feet and saying all this jibber jabber, and we don't know what he's saying. Well, the people with us started getting really afraid, and they were telling Kathy, you know, we really don't have to do this. Let's just turn around and get out of here before they get upset. And Kathy just turned around and looked at him and said, oh, he does this all the time. Don't worry about it.
Well, it's great to have someone with you that's got a lot of confidence in you. You know, that's a good thing.
Yeah, they were all just chewing their fingernails. They were just really worried about it.
Well, I'll tell you something. Some of what you've described is very similar to what I experienced in East Timor. And I have been backed up against the wall with my interpreter and spears at my chest and throat. And that's an experience that most people, I think, don't want to have.
Well, it's a little uncomfortable.
It is. It is.
We when we went back up the Tekachi Valley, we had people with us who were our guides that were carrying rifles and such. We didn't know at the time that these folks were part of the bad guys back there in the jungle. We just thought they were simple farmers who were really nice and taking us on this walk. But as it turns out, you know, they weren't. And you know, when we found out, we were way, way back in the jungle, away from civilization by several days. So it's a little uncomfortable when you find things out like that.
Okay, now let me get clear in my mind who were the bad guys. Now, the bad guys was the Bora, or this tribe where you ran into the guy who didn't care you were a god?
No, neither one of them. This is a different experience. When we were back in 2000, when we were walking back to Tekachi Valley, that's in east central Peru, in an area that's held by, you know, terrorists and narco traffickers and all this, and we had no idea.
Well, now this guy that you had to pay the $20 to, did you ever find out, is he like the chief, or is he the shaman, or, you know, is he the troll? What is this guy?
Well, he looked like the troll, but actually he was the chief of the Hebrew tribe. So he was the main guy.
What language do they speak? Does it sound anything at all like Spanish? Or Portuguese?
It's Quechua, but it's Quechua is a generalization of a language.
We'll get the answer to that when we come back. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Jerry Wills, and he's sharing with us some of the interesting moments that he experienced on this latest expedition to the Amazon and surrounding area. Now, Jerry, you were telling us that this is this language of, I think you said the Ibaru.
It's like with an H, Hebrew.
Hebrew. The language of these people is not Spanish. It's not Portuguese. And you were about to tell us what it is, and then we had to go to break. So what is it? What do they speak?
They speak Quechua. Quechua is an old language. It's one of the original languages. I think it's only thing older than that is Aymara, which is around southern Peru, Bolivia. And the The Quechua language in the jungle from one tribe to another can be different.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the jungle to the mountains, still amazingly different. So,
But are they able to communicate with each other?
Oh, yeah, in a general way. They can understand each other. Their second language is Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them all speak Spanish.
Well, it is an amazing thing how really even in a small area, relatively small area, you can have so many different dialects of the same language. And, you know, to me, I ran into that in East Timor, and it would sound the same to me. I mean, it was very, very similar. And yet they would, you'd run into someone who speaks Makassai, and he would tell you he doesn't speak Tetun. And yet I speak Tetun, and I could understand most of what the Makassai said. But they couldn't understand Tetun. And I always wondered if maybe they just didn't want to. Does that make sense?
Well, probably. And it has to do with class distinction as well. The people in the jungle who speak Quechua, if they go into town, they have to speak Spanish. Because if you speak Quechua, mm-hmm. you're a lower class person in Iquitos than if you speak Spanish. And if you speak English, well, you're just right at the top of the heap.
Well, you know, I've been in situations where I just pulled out one language after another and asked, do you speak this? Do you speak this? Do you speak this? You know, and I've been in places where, for instance, I was in Kosovo. After the NATO bombing and the Kosovar Albanians, who were not actually refugees, that was fiction, but they had left Kosovo and they returned. The longer they were back in Kosovo, the more they would refuse to speak Serbian. Well, I didn't speak Albanian. And so, you know, I was there as a cop, and I got flagged down by some people who had a traffic accident, and I was asking them, do you speak English? No. Okay. Do you speak Serbian? No. And this old guy, you know, kept telling me, you know, that he only speaks Albanian. Okay, now look, we're only a few weeks, actually a few months, since the Serbs were in charge of Kosovo, and they all spoke Serbian. I knew the guy was lying, but he refused to speak Serbian until I said in Serbian, well, if the Yugoslavian army comes back in here, I bet you speak Serbian. And then he sort of hung his head and he says, Da, ja govorim srpski. Yeah, I speak Serbian. But, you know, you run into that, and I wondered when I was in East Timor, out in the jungle, if that same kind of nonsense happens even out there.
It does. They don't want to be, they don't want to be like the people next door, basically. They want to be better. And it's sort of a cultural dignity they're trying to hold on to. I suspect that they have their own language, but I've never heard them speak it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I run into that in Thailand. So my wife, of course, is Thai. However, she's from a part of Thailand known as Isan, which used to be its own kingdom. And so there is the Isani language.
Uh-huh.
I can barely understand a little bit of Thai, but the Isani is very, very different. However, when they get together, very often they will either, they'll slip into Isani or they'll slip into Lao, which is very similar to Isani. And I don't know, it's just one of those things we don't run into much here in the United States. But, you know, I guess we will be running into it more and more. There's quite a number of people that say, hey, you're here, speak English. Well, while I understand that sentiment, you know, language is just a tool, and if we can figure out a language that two of us can speak, we're in business.
It reminds me of when my son was visiting me years ago. First time out in Arizona, he's real excited to go out into the desert and look around because he wanted to find a cowdy. And I said, a cowdy? What do you mean? He says, you know, a cowdy. So we went back and forth with that a few moments, and I'm like, okay, well, whatever you say, we'll go look for a cowdy. And I said, you're speaking this with a real deep southern drawl. Spell it. Well, it was coyote.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, people hearing us right now may wonder, well, what is all this talk about language got to do with the price of tea in China? But the truth is, if you go you go on an expedition somewhere and you go to places that are remote, language is a very serious component of you being able to do your work. And, you know, you got to find either a common language that the two, you and whoever you're trying to talk to, that both of you know, or you've got to find a third party that can translate for you. And, you know, it's language is one of the most important tools for expeditions, for discovery, doing any kind of exploring, any kind of advancement as the human race. Language is one of the most important tools. Now, you know me pretty well, Jerry. You know I generally don't start down a path unless I'm headed somewhere. Here's where I'm headed. I watched, we're going to have to do an expedition to Nubia, and we're going to have to do one to Vietnam. But I watched a documentary last week on the lost kingdom of Nubia. Most people think the Nubians were part of Egypt. They were not. They had their own kingdom. And they were highly advanced. They had huge buildings and pyramids and things similar to Egypt. In fact, their Nubian pyramids have held up better than the Egyptian pyramids, except for the Giza Plateau, which I don't think was built by the Egyptians. In this documentary, they showed the Nubian writing, and the Nubian writing has never been deciphered. No one knows what it says, even though they have a whole bunch of it. They've got a lot of examples of Nubian writing, but no one knows how to translate that language. That one fact alone keeps a lock on our knowledge of the Nubians.
I would like to see an example of the Nubian writing and compare that to what we found in northern Peru at Cumbamayo, because that language has never been translated either, and they've never been able to figure it out.
You found it where?
Cumbamayo, it's in northern Peru. Remember the thing that we found up there with the aqueducts that run through the mountain?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The writing's never been deciphered.
Is this it's actual writing and not pictograms?
Yes, yes, it's mm-hmm. actual. It's a language, but you know, there's no way of understanding it.
Yeah, this in Nubia is actual writing, as opposed to pictograms or hieroglyphs. It's actual writing. And at the same time, the Egyptians were using hieroglyphics. So now they used some, they borrowed some hieroglyphs from the Egyptians, and those can be read. But most of their stuff in Nubia was a language that was written down, you know, in script. You know, it was written. Nobody has any clue whatsoever as to what that means. But, Jerry, you know, one of the weird things, the archaeologist that was sort of featured in this documentary said, okay, well, we know that letter makes this sound. Now, she said, and we know that word is, and she pronounced the word. She said, but we don't know what that word means. How do they know what sound a letter makes? If there's no one around to speak the language, how do they know?
Yeah, well, I think they'd have to have a known language with both of the languages together so that you could make that comparison.
Yeah, but they don't. With this language, they don't. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for a Rosetta Stone kind of thing, so that they can begin to translate this writing in Nubia.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it would take. And, you know, the same story up in northern Peru. They don't have any way of comparing one to the other. Actually, most of the cultures up there, for example, the Inca, they didn't have a written language.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even have the wheel. And the other cultures that are found around there, they didn't have a written language either. This is the only written language that I know of that was in that area for time immemorable. And, you know, it's just too bad it can't be read because there's writing all over the place.
Well, we're going to step away for a break. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you, as the executive producer for Expeditions TV, the similarities between Ireland and Nubia. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Jerry Wills, the co-host or associate host of the Kevin Smith Show, and he is also the executive producer for Expeditions TV, having just returned from his latest expedition to South America. We're talking about things related to that expedition, although it may not seem like it's too much right at this moment, but you'll see the connection. Jerry, as we went to break, I said I was going to point out a similarity between the Nubians and, I said Ireland, but really the Celts, the Celtic civilizations. And the similarity is this. For the Celts, one of their greatest leaders, one of their greatest rulers, was a woman. Her name was Boudica. Boudica was the wife of a Celtic king that the Romans killed, and they raped her daughters, and she was excessively ticked. And she led a rebellion against the Romans that almost drove the Romans completely out of Britain. And have you ever heard of Hadrian's Wall?
Yes.
Well, it's there because of Boudica. They put that wall up there to keep her and her chariots from making it to Londinium, or London. She did make it before they put the wall there and wreaked havoc in Londinium. She was a big lady. She was about 6 feet, six feet two. Muscular, flaming red hair, drove a chariot better than most men and as good as all, and slung a mean sword. And she was one of the Celts' greatest leaders. Absolutely phenomenal leader. Well, the Nubians, their greatest leader was a big woman. She was the queen. And they said she could throw a spear far and straight, and she could use the implements of war as good as any man. So there's a similarity there. Now, here's how this connects up with your expedition and actually all of your expeditions. In all of these ancient civilizations in South America that you have explored, have you found a similar figure in South America? A woman that was a great leader and that was considered to be a great warrior as well?
Well, not exactly, but there's so much there still yet to be discovered. The one thing that has been found, and we've been invited into the area to cover for Expeditions TV, is a Chechapoyas site. Chechapoyas were the 6 foot or greater, or taller rather, 6 foot or taller people with red to blonde hair who lived way up in the mountains in the eyebrow of the Andes, in the rainforest basically and above. They had huge cities up there that were made of stone. And it was, you know, everyone marvels at Machu Picchu. These places are even more amazing and just huge. Well, there was a woman who was found in a special burial place up there who they think might have either been a shaman or a warrior. She was she wasn't tall, as I remember. She was more of the 5'9" to 6 foot tall size, but she was covered in tattoos, and they've never found a woman who was buried with all kinds of armament in any of these places before, because it's predominantly a male dominated society. But here is a woman who apparently was quite a warrior, and she was, you know, laid to rest in one of these ancient lost cities up in the Andes. And if we get a chance to go up there, I'll certainly have pictures, plenty of video to show everyone.
Well, you know, Jerry, you and I have talked about, and I've talked about it with other guests as well, the sort of commonalities, the universal things that we seem to find spread across the world. And one of the things that when we talk about that, that people very often think about is the pyramids, because you find pyramids on every continent in every ancient civilization. We're finding pyramids.
Right.
So this is one of the common things that, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, what's the thread? How did all of these cultures separated by thousands and thousands of miles and hundreds, sometimes thousands of years, still come up with this pyramid structure, and why? And that's a great mystery. But I think there are probably some other commonalities. I bet you that if we look at every ancient civilization, there is at some time there was a woman who was the supreme ruler and was considered one of their greatest rulers. And I bet we would find similar situations occurring that catapulted them to the top. Now, why is that important? The reason that's important is because if you're having similar situations occur, do you have similar people or the same group of people or beings orchestrating those situations? Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure. Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, something else that comes to mind, Kevin, is that the first place that the Amazon, as I recall anyway, the first place that the Amazon is mentioned is in Greek literature, and it has to do with the women of the Amazon being such fierce warriors. Mm-hmm. And there are stories that we've encountered where the Spanish were attacked by these Amazon women. They were tall and very good with a bow and arrow and spear, and phenomenal warriors. They couldn't beat them.
And what happened to them, according to the ancient legends or ancient texts? What happened to these Amazon female warriors?
Well, I really don't know. My suspicion is that if they did encounter the Spanish, as we've read that they did, that they probably also encountered the same diseases that killed off tens of thousands of the indigenous people throughout South America.
You know, we sometimes forget that bio-warfare, it can be a great deal more effective than guns, bullets, cannons, swords. And these conquistadors, even though they were not consciously conducting bio-warfare, did so by bringing European diseases to people who had no immunity. The same thing happened up in Alaska, you know. The common cold just about wiped out people in Alaska, the native people. And then the flu, that nearly got them. Because they had never had those diseases, and they had no immunity to them. And then when white men showed up carrying all our bugs with us, you know, it was a matter of bio warfare, maybe unintentional, but it still happened.
Yeah, well, it certainly happened to a great extent in South America. We've come across mass graves with hundreds of people in there, and it's just a big hole full of, you know, their remains. And the reason why they were thrown in there is because they contracted smallpox and they died.
All right, now, you, one of the pictures you sent me, and I apologize, folks, I don't have it set up here to show it to you, but one of the pictures you sent me from this expedition shows, it appears that you're up on top of a mountain. It's just a very sandy looking place, and there's a human skull sitting out there and some ribs exposed out on the sand. We'll talk about that on the other side of this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. And for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and my sympathy to you for whatever kept you away from the first hour. My guest this evening is Jerry Wills. He is the associate host of this show, and he is the executive producer for Expeditions TV. Jerry, you were talking about having found mass graves, I guess, up in the Andes. Is that where?
Actually, in the deserts of Nazca. We've found very large grave sites up in the Andes as well, but they were ceremonial. In other words, the people had prepared them. It was a final resting place for their ancestors and so forth. It wasn't just a hole that they were thrown in. But in the deserts of Peru, in the area we were just in, for example, there are places where there were just mass graves, just big holes dug and bodies thrown into it, done so by the Spanish, because thousands of the indigenous people who lived there had come down with the flu or smallpox or something of this nature, something terrible, and it killed them. And so they, instead of individual graves, they dug great big holes and they threw them in there and covered them back up again.
Okay, now this picture that you sent me from this latest expedition, where there's it's a sandy area, there are mountains all around. It kind of looks like maybe you're on top of a mountain or up in the mountains, and there's a skull just sitting out on the surface, and some ribs kind of scattered around, rib bones, and they're bleached, very, very white. It looks ancient. What's that all about?
Well, that is an area that is about an hour's drive west of Nazca. At that point, we're still a couple of hours from the Pacific Ocean. This is just the desert, you know, a very vast and dry place. The picture was taken at one of these grave sites where hundreds of bodies had just been thrown into holes out in the middle of nowhere. Now they call this the necropolis, which basically is place of the dead. But these, you know, the graves were shallow, and there were so many bodies that, and the wind blowing, moving the sand, eventually exposing the bones, and there were just bones of all kinds, skulls of all kinds, just all around us. And really hundreds of depressions in the ground where these bodies had been dug up by grave robbers in the past, and the remains just scattered about the desert.
Do they still have problems with grave robbers now, or is that something that's pretty much in the past?
No, they will always have problems with grave robbers. The thing is, you know, here you have you have agencies watching, and you have all kinds of police agencies ready to spring into action.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, you don't have any agencies watching, and the local police, if you happen to, let's say, find half a dozen gold necklaces, well, you're going to keep those gold necklaces, and you're going to pay off the police not to bother you before you go out to dig.
Mm-hmm.
So they just make a bribe to the locals, to the local police, and they go out, do their thing, and they're gone. No one knows who did it, and no one knows what was taken. And that makes it really frustrating for archaeologists or people trying to put together a pattern in order to explain somewhat of the history that might have been possible.
Well, now, all of these graves, these mass graves, where the Spanish dumped all of these bodies of people that had succumbed to diseases, do we know who these people were? Do we know what tribe they were?
Well, they were... no, not really. They were just the indigenous people. The ones that were the most unique to Kathy and I were the ones who had the cone-shaped head. Because it's obvious in some instances that these people had shaped their baby's head into this cone-like appearance. But in some instances, the heads weren't shaped. That's just how they were born. And a good example of this is in the museum in Ica, at least it was in Ica, I don't know if it's still there or not, but there was a woman, you know, a mummified woman with a fetus, and the woman has a cone-shaped head, and so does the unborn fetus. And these heads are unique because there are extra bones in the skull that are not present in modern or even ancient humans. This is an entirely different breed of person, and that's never really being addressed adequately. The reason why the woman and fetus mummy aren't even shown is because it can't be explained. It doesn't fit into traditional archaeology, and so it's hidden away in the basement in the museum at Ica City. But if you get the right person, then they'll be very happy to point out these differences in the skulls. And once you know what you're looking at, it becomes very obvious that you're not looking at a human skull. And some of these were the people who were thrown into these mass graves.
At any of these mass graves that you've seen, have you seen the cone-shaped skulls?
No, for the most part, the remains have been completely scattered, broken, thrown about.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen any cone-shaped skulls. We've been looking for them, but we just haven't seen them.
All right, now, these cone-shaped skulls are very interesting, and it's another one of those, okay, we've got civilizations separated by thousands of miles and by hundreds of years, and yet we find those cone-shaped skulls in existence in other civilizations. For instance, in Egypt. So,
yeah.
What do you think? Are these extraterrestrials?
Well, I'm inclined to think that if they're not extraterrestrial, they are another version of mankind that has yet to be explained. The likelihood that they are extraterrestrial, to me, seems very high in likelihood, because they're just so different.
Now, you said they have a different bone structure in the skull. What's different about it?
Oh, let's see. Well, there's a couple of differences. There's just, you know, where you've got the plates of the skull and how it all comes together for a normal human. These skulls have one or two more bones. And if it was just an odd occurrence where it was one skull that had it, or maybe two, you could say, well, that's some really odd and unique genetic variety that just appeared and disappeared quickly. But there are dozens and dozens of these that show that it was indeed an entirely different genetic group altogether, that it was something being handed down, parents to child, over a long period of time. And then you don't see any more of these cone heads show up anywhere. It's like they showed up at a certain point in time, and they disappeared at a certain point in time, and that's it. Except for the ones that are wrapped. And the ones that are wrapped, they're showing up at the same time or a little after the cone-shaped head as a naturally occurring shape for these people. You're seeing people trying to emulate that with their children, and the only reason a person would do that is because the people with the cone-shaped heads, I think they would have been considered important somehow, whether they were considered deities or rulers or the ruling caste.
So in other words, you had the common people doing what is called boarding, putting little boards and binding those boards around the skulls of their children to force the skull to grow into a cone shape. And you're saying they're doing that to emulate the real cone heads, which would indicate, since they're emulating them, that the real cone heads were held in high esteem.
Yeah, exactly right. But you can see the difference in the shape of the skull. You can see the striations in the skull where it was wrapped, and you can see the indentations where they used wrappings or boards. It actually left marks in the shape of the bone itself.
Okay, I want to open up the telephone lines, Jerry, and allow our audience to join us and participate in the conversation with us. Folks, the telephone number here in the studio, as always, is 623-444-5889. Toll free in the USA and Canada, it is 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, you can call the main number, 623-444-5889, or send me a flash message by going to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Scroll down, you'll see the link right beside the picture for tonight's show. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hey,
hello,
how
Terry.
Are you? Hi, Jerry.
Hi there.
I'd like to, if I can, take Jerry back a little bit when he was talking about the red-haired, 6-foot-tall people that were living in the mountains in that area that you was talking about earlier.
Okay, what do you want to know about it? What do you want him to comment on, Terry?
I just want to know if he meant they are living there or they did live there.
No, they no longer, so far as I know, they're no longer found in the Andes. I've heard rumors that there are some who are in the far southern reaches of the Andes, but I've not had any proof about that. As for the ones that lived there previously, no, I think they're all gone.
Okay, yeah, because what I asked is, we here in Ohio, we have legends of tall, red-haired peoples that the Indians had to excavate from this area before they could live here peacefully. So I was just kind of curious whether there was some kind of connection there, maybe. You also mentioned that the ruins up there are more fascinating than Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu. Yeah, because what I understand is that the place that's got all the little heads on the wall, and it's made out of pyrite and granite.
No. What you're talking about is Grand Chichapoyas. I forgot the name of the other place. Pahatain. That's it. Pahatain has a path that goes up around the mountain, and there are skulls. They were actual skulls, though. They weren't carved out of rock. And there is a line of skulls all the way up the mountain, up this path, getting to Pahatain. And at Pahatain, there were skulls at the entrance, and it was a formidable place to go into. We haven't been there yet. It's about a 5-day hike into some really, really remote areas of the jungle. And, of course, that means a 5-day hike back out again, and we just haven't done that.
Yeah. Okay, I was just kind of confused there, because I understand, from what I understand from scientists, they say that that place, made out of pyrite and granite, the only thing harder is diamonds. And they say the way that place was constructed, they say basically that makes the pyramids and everything else that we've been finding in Child's Play How true that is, I don't know, but, you know, I was kind of confused there, wondering, you know, what you were saying there.
Sure.
So I think that's all
Machu
I got.
Machu Picchu is kind of a tourist location. It's outside of Cuzco by about 3 hours. The place you're talking about, Pahatain, that's in the eyebrow of the jungle, and that was part of the Chechapoya stronghold. The warriors lived there.
All right, Terry, thank you for the call. Folks, again, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. Toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. And then we have the flash message option for those of you who are outside of the USA and outside of Canada. Jerry, one of the things that really captivates me about all these places that you go in South America is that the more we find out about these ancient civilizations in South America, the more we discover that our history in the Americas is vastly different from what we've been told.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the prevailing theory about how native peoples populated the Americas is that they came across this land bridge from Siberia. Well, for those who don't know, that means they would be entering the Americas at the extreme north. So you would expect the great population centers to develop first there. They didn't. They developed first in Central and South America. And the great cities were built first in Central and South America. So something is amiss in the story we've been told. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, guys. How's it going over there?
Good.
Yeah, excellent.
Well, I kind of had something to bring to the table. We're kind of connecting a lot of things together. You were talking about similarities between things.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that, which it pretty much shows that they were trying to imitate those people's cones' heads. Now, I remember when Kevin showed some of the Egyptian women, or the woman that had the cone-shaped head, and she had the king who had a half-cone-shaped head, they were showing the pictures of her with a nice hat on, which fit her head very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed Christianity has the Pope, who has a hat that doesn't fit his head too well. And if people were trying to imitate the cone-shaped head, do you think that if you were a religion and you're trying to have a place of authority and spiritual awareness and all that and stuff, they would try to imitate the kind of dressings that you would put on the cone head? Is that a possibility? And also, can Kevin take off his hat to make sure that he doesn't have a cone? We need to make sure. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, Kevin does have a cone head. That's why he wears the hat.
Yes, I'm an alien. All right, so what do you think, Jerry? You think that the reason for the Pope's mitre is to emulate the cone heads?
Well, you know, it sounds like a really interesting theory. I hadn't given that a lot of thought, but I'm going to.
Yeah, I have to admit, I had never thought of that before either. So I don't know. All right, back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, John from Vancouver Island.
Okay, John.
Hello, John.
Hi. Hi. You're talking about how you would go into different areas and the people wouldn't actually speak the language, even though you suspected they would.
Yeah, are you referring to me or Jerry?
Well, actually, both. Like, you both described that
okay.
situation. Yeah. So, what I'm saying about that is, I'm thinking that Aboriginal people got wise to the idea that if they spoke the language of the dominant governing force, they might actually be considered citizens, in which case they would be subject to the laws of the land that were determined by the dominant governing force. So being free people, being Aboriginals, they probably wouldn't want to speak a particular dominant language.
That's a very good point. And the idea that their language would be reflecting the dominant power in the area for these tribes, you know, they would eventually get so large they'd break off, and that's how an area would become occupied by a certain group, like the Hebrew, for example, or the Bora, for another example. Their tribe got hundreds of members, and it's over a large area. So, no, they wouldn't want to speak some other dialect because they are the rulers of their kingdom, and to speak some other dialect would be to be subservient to them. It's a very good point.
It is a good point.
Yeah, and it kind of relates to the people, you know, shaping the cone heads to reflect the authority in the region.
How so?
Go ahead.
Yeah, like it's the same type of thing. It's like they're speaking a language. If they, do the cone head thing, then by physical birth, they would become part of the authority. And if they were trying to fake that, then they would become part of the rulership rather than those being ruled.
That's another good point, John. And something that's occurred to me is that what if this child who's having its head shaped, what if its father happened to be one of these conehead guys, and that gene wasn't passed on to the child? In order to show that it belongs to that, they would shape its head.
Uh-huh.
Just a theory. I don't know.
Oh,
if that's
yeah.
True or not.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, John, thank you very much for the call. These cone heads also appeared in Europe. There were operations or expeditions conducted to round them up and kill them. They also appeared in Europe.
Oh.
You know, the there's another thing about with the language. I'm going to put the picture of the atheist you ran into in the jungle. I'm going to put that picture back up on the screen
okay.
for a moment. When we see someone like this, and you know, we're coming from the land of iPods, we have a tendency to think these people are not so bright. I'm going to address that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back. As we went away for break, I had put this fellow's picture back up on our TV channel, and let me do that again. And I said, you know, you come from the land of iPods, iPads, cell phones, smartphones, HD television, all the gadgetry in the world, and you walk upon a fellow like this out in the jungle, There's a tendency that, unfortunately, Westerners sometimes have, and I'm certainly not implying you have this tendency, Jerry. I know you know better. But the tendency is to look at this and look at this whole situation, the living conditions in the village, the way people are dressed or not dressed, and to sort of have the impression these people are not too bright. And that's a huge mistake, because these people are excessively bright. They just live in a different world than we live in. Now, if we take Jerry Wills, and we take this fellow in the grass suit, and we drop the two of you out in the jungle in an area that's not his village, I guarantee you, he's the one who's going to survive.
Oh yeah, absolutely so. He'll be the one who'll know his way around.
Yeah, and here's another thing. I ran across this time and time and time again out in these villages in East Timor, and I bet it's the same in these villages in Central and South America as well. These people very often speak multiple languages. I've met people that spoke as many as 9 languages out in these villages, and but they don't want. No matter what language you bring up, they'll tell you, no, they don't speak that language. But later on, after you get to know them and you become friends with them, you find out, yeah, they really did speak that language. They're not stupid people, and that's one of the best ways for them to gather intel on you is to pretend they don't understand any of those languages that you intend to speak. Because when you turn around and you do you speak English? No, they don't speak English. You turn around and speak to your friends in English, they're listening, and they may understand everything you say. They're not stupid people.
No, they're not at all. They're just because they don't have our education. Our education is specific to our needs and this culture we live within. But you go out there to the jungle, your education isn't going to do anything for you except lead you down a path of destruction. These folks have traditions handed down to them, father to son, for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, and their education, it rules. They know the details. If you get bit by a snake, for example, they know what moss to boil or what flower to pick and squeeze on the sap onto your snake bite to nullify it. They have knowledge far in excess of ours, really.
You know, Jerry, I've told you before that in East Timor they have the green mamba snake.
Yeah.
Very deadly. They call it a two-step viper. But you know, every year some few of the natives get bitten by that thing, and most of them survive. You're exactly right. They know how to take care of it. All right, let's go back to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Mike from Kentucky.
Yeah, Mike.
Hello,
hey,
Mike.
How you doing, Jerry?
Good, man.
Glad to have you back.
Thank you.
Based on that picture I just looked at, do they have lawnmowers?
It looks like they do, doesn't it?
It does. That's why I wondered. That was a nice manicured little grass, you know, considering they live in the jungle, so... How primitive are they?
they are primitive. What they have, they have pigs and sheep.
Yeah.
And it keeps all the grass chewed down.
Yeah, well, I pretty much knew that was probably going to be an answer that you were going to give animals. But it does almost look like it's manicured there a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to call in, say hi, and let you know that looking forward to hearing more about what you got to report on. And, Kevin, thanks for having Jerry on tonight.
All right, thanks for the call.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, as Jerry said at the beginning, there's not a lot to report in terms of new discoveries because it wasn't that type of an expedition. But some new experiences anyway. One of the things that you experienced and your group that you were leading got to experience it is you got to the Bora village, and they had a little greeting kind of a ceremony where the ladies were dancing and chanting, and it sort of took the tourist aback. And the reason being that they were not fully dressed.
Yeah, it certainly was a surprise for them. I told them that it was a primitive village of native Amazonians they were going to meet that had previously been headhunters, and that they'd be treated very well because we were part of their tribe. Excuse me, Kathy and I had been made a part of their tribe 10 years ago or so. When we walked into the area near where we were greeted, all we saw were a couple of men and a few boys. The boys were completely naked, and the men just had on this, you know, loincloth-like thing with, you know, stick or spear in one hand and feathers in their hair and, you know, headdress and paint on their body. We walked into the main building, which basically is a series of poles sunk in the ground with a pagoda kind of thatch roof hut, cone-shaped, that's quite tall. And here came all the women of all ages, and more children, and more men. And the women were wearing really no more than the men were wearing. And many of them didn't have anything on at all. And then, you know, they greeted us and told us all about the Well, of course, we already knew, Kathy and I, but told the tourists all about themselves. And here was a welcoming dance. And so they took off and started chanting and beating a log on the floor and stomping their feet, and they just started dancing. Well, within about 15 minutes, they'd gone through two different dances, and now they were doing the welcome dance, where they're welcoming you into their midst. So they started dancing again. And the women come, and this was all men. There were no women except for Kathy. And the women came and grabbed a man, and they held hands in a long line, two long lines, actually. And they're dancing back and forth. All these guys are dancing with all these gals, going back and forth, back and forth. And the men of the tribe are standing around beating the log and chanting and singing along as well. It was hysterically funny, the expression on their face. They never expected that.
Yeah, one of the pictures that you sent to me shows one of the guys that they'd grabbed his hands and pulled him into the line to dance, and he looks like, oh, my God, what is this?
Yeah, it's too bad you can't put that up. That really is funny. But
although there's nothing pornographic about these pictures, folks. It's just the way the natives live. Think National Geographic, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's just the way they live. Still, because we're on during prime time, I decline to show those on our TV channel because kids are still up, you know? All right, now look, you described another thing that's sort of universal. This main building that you described, I have found the same building throughout the jungles in East Timor. Okay, it's kind of a cone-shaped top.
Uh-huh.
and just sitting on top of some poles. Other than the roof, it's open, right?
Right. Yeah.
Now, in East Timor, they have the same thing. The cone-shaped top, and this is very interesting, any building in the village that has a roof like that, that belongs to the chief. His house has it. And then they have this sort of a community center. It's just a roof like that, erected up on some poles. It's got that cone-shaped top. This is where the chief meets with the community.
Yeah, same is true in the jungle, or where the chief meets with visitors.
Yeah, yeah. And that cone-shaped roof, I think, must have a linkage somehow to the Conehead people. It's a symbol of authority.
Yeah, very good point.
I made the mistake, you know, I mentioned earlier that I have been in a situation where I had spears. I was backed up against the wall, and I had spears pressed against my throat and against my chest. And a whole bunch of other people standing back there with their hands up and the spear in their hand and cocked and ready to throw. Well, I made the mistake of meeting with the chief at his home. If I had been out in their, I call it the community center, this building that you and I had been talking about, if I had been out there, they would have never raised their spears to me. Because that's like the chief sitting on the throne, like the king sitting on the throne, and there will be no problem at that building.
Well, and that was one of the things the people were a little concerned about going back through the Hebrew village and going back to the village where all the Bora live, because that's a restricted area. And they were really a little worried, I think, because we were going someplace that people aren't normally allowed to go, but they had faith it was all right because I was leading the way. And, of course, we had been invited. It was interesting when we got to the village, everybody came out of their houses and took a moment to look to see who it was. And when they saw it was me, then all these people crowded around asking how we'd been, where we'd been, why did we not come back sooner, and so forth. So it really relieved the tension.
Yeah.
For anyone else to have gone back there, you know, they wouldn't have been welcome.
Well, and the same kind of, I've had that same sort of experience. You know, once they see who it is, if they know you, and if they have previously accepted you, you're okay. Everything's cool. All right, we're going to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. We are on final approach. That means we only have a few minutes left. Jerry, you know, I have been bringing up this whole concept of some rather universal things that we see in various cultures, various civilizations all around the world, separated by thousands of miles and hundreds of years. But, you know, this thing about the Coneheads is fascinating, because they didn't just happen in South America. They happened in Egypt, they happened in Europe, and probably in Asia, and maybe other places. But you know, there are indications that cone shaped skull was a symbol of authority that these were the ruling elite. And then we see structures that seem to imitate that cone shape that are the seats of power, for instance, in these villages.
Right.
But even in the United States, what is the shape of the building that says this is the United States government?
Yeah. And,
it's a dome.
The dome.
And how many countries around the world have a dome for their capital?
Yeah.
A great many. A great many. And, you know, one must, I think, wonder if perhaps that is the origin also of pyramids.
Well, you know, it could be.
I don't know. But, you know, these, I think if we could ever get any solid information on these conehead people, for instance, DNA testing to see are they exactly the same DNA human genome as us, or is there some difference? If we could get that kind of information, I think we would find out there is some difference.
Well, you know, and I put that question to the assistant that we had when we were down in Peru when we did the video Secrets of the Sand. And he told us that DNA testing had been done and that these were different, but that the results hadn't been published because it would cause too many problems.
Who is it that told you this?
It's the fellow who appears with us when we're looking at the cone heads. I've forgotten his name now. But he's, as strange as it sounds, though I've forgotten his name, he is kind of a friend of ours. I just can't remember his name at this moment.
Well, that's because you're getting old.
Well, something's happening. I'm not sure what it is.
Oh. You see, I myself never have a problem like that.
Of course not.
No. I left the studio yesterday morning, walked out of the studio to go down the hall to the coffee machine to get some coffee, right? That was my intention. I caught myself because I walked out of the studio with the intention to get some coffee. I left my coffee cup sitting in the studio, and instead of turning left to go to the coffee machine, I turned right and headed down towards the restroom. And then I caught myself, and I thought, wait a minute, where am I going? What am I doing? I'm getting old, Jerry.
Well, you know, it happens. I met a guy today who's 20 years old. He was telling me all about, he's in the bank. He's telling me all about something. And I said, gee whiz, you know, I was 20 once. And he just looked at me.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. The alternative to getting old is getting dead. So I prefer getting old.
You know, it is kind of nice, though, when people are kind and they tell you, gee, you don't look like you've aged a bit since I saw you last time. The downside is that the last time they saw you was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. Okay, so this guy tells you that they have done DNA testing and that the genome is different from us. Did he tell you in what ways it's different?
I don't really think he knew. He just was kind of telling me what he had been told because he was an archaeological assistant. So the archaeologist probably told him, but, you know, didn't go into that much detail.
Mm-hmm.
We run into this quite a bit, you know, things that are found, things that are discovered, whether it's with DNA or evidence. And the archaeologist, he might have the details that would be quite, you know, revealing.
Mm-hmm.
But if he were to release those with his name on it, then he stands the risk of losing funding, losing his position, And let's face it, these guys are down there because they've gotten a grant somewhere. They're hired by someone. And if they lose their funding or their position, then they're going to be flipping burgers at the burger joint before long.
That's true. That's true. They have to toe the mark.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's one of the good things about Expeditions TV. It doesn't have to toe the mark.
Exactly. And if we find something out, we're going to bring it to everyone and not do it in a, I don't think we do it in a biased way. I could be wrong. But we try to bring it so that you can make your own decision about what you're seeing.
Well, I think one of the most fascinating videos that you have produced is the one with all of the, with, you know, about the aqueduct across the top of the Andes. Absolutely fascinating. Let's take our final call for the evening. Ladies and gentlemen, after this call, the telephone lines will be closed. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Clay from Arkansas.
Yes, Clay.
Yeah, I can't hear you too good, but anyway, my question is, prospecting down in Mexico, is there any rules or regulations about it? And I'll hang up and let you, I mean, just looking for gold. Okay, thank you, bye.
Well, what about that? If you go down to Peru to look for gold, are there rules about that?
Gold?
Yeah.
Well, there are two kinds of gold you'll find. One type is gold that's been made into jewelry or some kind of an artifact, some artistic piece. The other is just a chunk of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wants to know about just prospecting for gold. Is there some kind of restriction on that?
Oh, I don't know. I've never looked into that.
Yeah.
But if he wants to go prospecting for gold, that area that we were in around Cajamarca has got the world's second largest gold deposit, and there are people throughout the mountains in that region that have chunks of gold, literally, just sitting around their house. It's just unbelievable.
Well, Jerry, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's always fascinating to hear from you, especially when you've just come back from an expedition. And I look forward to you being with us again.
Thanks for having me on, Kevin, and thanks, everyone, for listening. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Stay on the phone with me for a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, there are explorers and there are archaeologists. They are different things. Jerry is an explorer, and he has found some amazing things that he's brought back to us via video. Now, if you will go to Expeditions TV, and that's not EX, it's just expeditionstv.com. You'll be able to look at an array of videos that he's brought back from the jungles and from the mountaintops. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.